Good afternoon. No relationships to disclose. This is a little bit about what I want to do. I want to focus on my topic, sexual and gender minority health, being vulnerable, stigma, and marginalization, the context in which I primarily work and know Virginia, and therefore a little bit of an LGBT health historical walkthrough. History is very important to Virginians, and it should be to ethicists. Public health ethics, addressing vulnerability, and then comments, responses, questions, which will be at the end. Also, I'll say the progress of this presentation goes from the world in which I work, which is with local and state health departments and community-based health organizations. And it's very important to me to speak their language, which is using data and literature. But in the world of ethical and moral reflection, as I get to the end, I'm just presenting considerations and questions because I don't necessarily have the answers, and I leave that up to the community. So that's a little bit of the progress. Okay, what's this? That's what that is. These are data that we know about LGBT households in the U.S. A dot is 100 households by counties. If you live somewhere in the U.S., find out where you live. Okay, so that's what that is, data. Here's some more data. There aren't much data, but this is a little bit about what we know. These are 2010 U.S. Census data. You can read the figures, 5.5 per 1,000 households. Those are same-sex or gay and lesbian couples. There's a range. D.C. had the highest in this census accounting, 18 per 1,000 households, and North Dakota had the lowest, 2 per 1,000. My context, Virginia, right there in the middle, 4.7 per 1,000. And from these data, we also could know, once again, very limited data, 16% of the couples, 34% of the couples who identified as spouses, and 12% of the unmarried partners are raising children. So many of these households in Virginia and in the U.S. are raising children. We don't know much, but we know that. These are some reporting of data that would be, if we were going to talk about across the country, the literature, apparently, to these experts show that we might talk about 3.5% of the adult U.S. population being lesbian, gay, or bisexual. And you can go and look at their research and see how they come up with the figure of 700,000 transgender Americans. And those are by identity. And then there are data that look at endorsed behavior and endorsed attraction, and the numbers become much larger, correct? An important review of the sexual and gender minority health literature is this article, which you can go to if you wanted to look at that. We see that an important context of LGBT health in the U.S., and I would say in most other settings, has to do with deprivation, vulnerability, marginalization, lack of access, the things that this talk is or this session is about. In this study also, looking at the literature, they used the Healthy People 2010 indicators, because this is an older study, and of the indicators that were in Healthy People 2010, all of them but three showed increased concern for this population. Now, I think that you'll know that we're now in the era of Healthy People 2020, and in Healthy People 2020, there are different indicators, but actually that raises some concern because one of the new indicators is violence, and the literature speaks volumes about increased concern for violence experienced by LGBT populations. And there's an added indicator this year for social determinants of health, and the literature again shows that we would have increased concern for this population. Some more words about vulnerability. We'll race on through. This was a little bit of a summary that I want to use. So in a special issue of American Journal of Public Health, the editor of the volume talked about these two constructs, existence of homophobia and transphobia, and rarity with which data on these dimensions are collected. On that one construct, we see vulnerability clearly there. Considering the exceptional diversity within and between these very diverse populations, one common ground is marginalization and vulnerability. And we also know from many reports and many studies that there's little data. These lead us down the pathway to understanding stigma and marginalization, vulnerability. There are certainly public policy standards now that are asking states, perhaps other local jurisdictions, to be collecting population data on sexual and gender minority communities. It's still very rarely done, sometimes for methodological reasons and sometimes for non-methodological reasons. There are some good literature, and I'm just highlighting several studies that show strong associations between state-level policy, structural inequalities, structural violence, whatever word you want to use, structural determinants of health, and LGBT health. And this is one important study, and this author, Hotzenbuehler, has done another one, which you'll see later. So he shows in this that in states that had banned gay marriage, United States that had banned gay marriage, we have significant increases in various types of psychiatric morbidity. So this distress, morbidity, vulnerability is associated strongly. We can't say caused, but we can say associated strongly with state practices. And this is looking at it from a slightly different angle, because the increased psychiatric distress and morbidity and vulnerability are, in this study, could be, we understand they could be modified by state protective policies. So we're looking, he looked at it in two different ways. This is an interesting study using an economic model, and they have an economic theory that in states, in U.S. states that are more tolerant toward LGBT populations, there may be less burden of HIV. And they run that through an economic model. We can discuss whether this model is one we agree with. Nevertheless, their data show that in states that are less tolerant, we might expect a heavier burden of HIV. Here's the little walkthrough. So in terms of, which is important to me because I live in Virginia, Virginians love history. And ethicists should love history too. And there's that wonderful phrase, was it Faulkner, who said, it's not even the past to Southerners, it's still there. So, you know, it's not, the past isn't even the past in the South, and certainly not in Virginia. The past is not the past. And a poor Captain Cornish is the first known person executed in the New World as constructed by the Europeans for homosexual activity. That was in the Virginia colony in 1624. I think this is my point of view, that the intersections of oppression work very strongly, and so I'm pointing out some other aspects of Virginia history that are about oppression and marginalization. We'll come down to 1777, good old Thomas Jefferson, whose home I drive by every time I go to work, wanted to get rid of all the aristocratic ideas in the old Virginia law, and in doing so, decided to, rather than killing people for their same-sex behavior, they would just be castrated if they were male and mutilated if they were female. I think the mutilation was cutting off their earlobes or parts of their ears. Once again, your ethicists are well familiar with these aspects of eugenic law. Some of these started in Virginia or had a seedbed, strong seedbed in Virginia. As a reminder, as we're getting closer in history to our present time, in 1975, not that long ago, Virginia continued to uphold and defend its crimes against nature's law. We have this amendment in the Virginia Constitution so that same-sex relationships that even look like, smell like, taste like marriage are prohibited. And the it is felt powerfully in communities in Virginia to be about anti-gay oppression, even though it's not phrased that way. A recent candidate for Virginia Attorney General is quoted in the Washington Post, said that homosexual acts were intrinsically wrong and unhealthy and not healthy to society. Once, so again, tying directly to health of populations. And this is a little bit more about Virginia law. The current Attorney General, as recent as 2010, gave an opinion that LGBT populations could not be protected against discrimination in the workplace. Once again, as late as this year, Virginia continues to defend its crimes against nature law. This is a little bit flash forward because this is an area that I know. A decade or more of community-based participatory research that is driven by funding and concern for HIV transmission in Virginia has really evolved an interesting body of social and behavioral research on LGBT populations. We actually have a multi-method, multi-year study on transgender health in Virginia. Surprise, surprise. But thank you. But thank you. So we have some experience and knowledge that's been built up in Virginia, in my context, at the same time a body of knowledge nationally and internationally has been developing. And we're proud of that. But what can we do about it? There are many impediments. We have very limitations on building public health capacity or community health capacity. And even things that communities can do in terms of routine networking is, I say, inconsistent, ad hoc, and untried. So this is driven by resources. So let's get to some ethical issues, and this is what I'm proposing in the more considerations of ethical reflection that doesn't have an answer, but it pulls it out to the community to think about and discuss. But I do like citations. So from one resource, we can talk about general moral considerations, and these thinkers talk about avoiding, preventing, and removing harms. If you look back or remember back to the literature I showed you about how state-level practices can engage harms, what does this moral principle instruct us or tell us or inform us about that? How does that shape our ethical reflection? There is a public health code of ethics, and in the preamble, there's a special place given to consideration about interdependence within society and trust. An example of one principle: public health should advocate and work for the empowerment of disenfranchised community members and ensure that basic resources and conditions necessary for health are accessible for all. And a gloss on that principle talks about the community voice. I'm giving some illustrations that could be used for reflection, which we won't have time for here. I think this is being recorded, so I use raw material from my actual experience in Virginia to construct these illustrations, but I'm not saying that there's any particular agency or individuals involved. These are just illustrations, but they're from experience. I can tell you about them if you want to know. Here, for example, a state health department notifies contractors that it plans to eliminate support for a type of intervention called balls or ballroom communities, which are venues for HIV, syphilis, and other outreach and testing. These are cultural institutions favored by hard-to-reach, vulnerable, young, gay, and bisexual men of color, who have and they have been demonstrated as effective for identifying and referring new cases of HIV, syphilis, and other health problems. What do the principles of community voice and empowerment of disenfranchised community, if these are principles that we uphold in our ethical reflection, tell us in as we reflect ethically on this illustration? Another principle from the Public Health Code of Ethics: public health programs and policies should be implemented in a manner that enhances physical and social environment. And the gloss is that based on this assumption, it helps to enact the value of interdependence among people. Once again, this emphasis on welcome. the emphasis on interdependence. Again, an illustration. A state health department is influenced by real or perceived anti-LGBT stigma within the state when deciding not to include an LGBT health question in the statewide population health survey. So you understand, as you remember from the early part, there's very little data. There may be some methodological reasons why states or other jurisdictions don't collect data, but there would be other reasons too. And what do the ethical principles of empowerment and interdependence tell us about how data should be used, collected in public health? There is some guidance that distinguishes differences between human subject research or participant research on participants and subjects and public health research. They're not the same thing. However, I want to suggest that while these distinctions exist, a common ground may be protection of the dignity of persons and communities involved in either human subjects research, public health research, or public health practice. I'm hoping that ethical reflection would always bring us back to some consideration of the dignity of persons and communities. An illustration, a state secretary plans to survey public employees regarding health of the workforce, including the state and local health departments in planning, who have been involved in planning, and they will also be a part of the workforce education. The state health department and the local health departments request inclusion of a question that allows employees to identify their same-sex partnerships and households, but the secretariat opposes inclusions of the question and further opposes collection of voluntary information. What does an understanding in our ethical reflection of dignity of persons and community, how does that inform our ethical reflection on this illustration? Looking back to some policies and discourse that relate to inclusion of persons in research. Investigators and IRBs are to consider scientific linkages between sex, gender, and topic of study and appropriate and culturally sensitive outreach activities. So some questions I would raise. What might be the investigator's responsibility to assess the inclusion of LGBT subpopulations as scientific evidence is developed? It is being developed. What will happen? Will these populations be considered by investigators? And what might be the responsibility of an IRB member or the IRB collectively to assign concern to inclusion of those populations? Thank you.